His lips turn blue, even as his face turns chalk white. The story he fabricated and rehearsed in his head so many times suddenly eludes him. Rather than present himself as eager for the entire strangers to be captured, Mudd is vague and contrary. He mentions that one stranger had a broken leg, and that he had done the neighborly thing by splinting it before sending the men on their way. When Lovett asks him to repeat parts of the story, Mudd frequently contradicts his own version of events. Lieutenant Lovett is positive that Samuel Mudd is lying, but he does not arrest him, not now at least. He's determined to find evidence that will link Mudd to the two strangers. He bawls the order to mount up, and the cavalry trots back out into the main road. Mudd, his heart beating in relief, can only wonder when they will return. Chapter 56, Thursday, April 20th, 1865, Maryland countryside, 4 a.m. George Azarode has chosen to escape via a northeast route, rather than push south like Booth and Harrell. This takes him into a much more pro-Union territory, where the Lincoln assassination is people demanding vengeance on the perpetrators. On the surface, Azarode's plan is an act of genius, allowing one of the most wanted men in America to literally hide in plain sight. But the increasingly unbalanced Azarode is not a genius. His escape is not a premeditated act of egress, but rather a random wandering from home to home, accepting sanctuary and comfort wherever it can be found. He dawdles when he should be making continuous progress. After 4 days on the run, he makes a critical mistake, boldly supporting Lincoln's assassination while eating dinner with strangers. His statements quickly make their way to U.S. Marshals. Now, as Azarode takes refuge at a cousin's house in the small community of Germantown, Maryland, 20 miles outside of Washington, a cavalry detachment knocks at the door. Entering the house, they find Azarode sharing a bed with two other men. "Get up and dress yourself," a sergeant commands. There is no fight, no attempt to pretend he shouldn't be arrested. George Azarode goes meekly into custody, where he is soon fitted with wrist shackles, a ball and chain on his ankle, and a hood over his head, just like Lewis Powell. Less than 3 months later, George Azarode, the 29-year-old drifter who stumbled into the conspiracy and stumbled right back out without harming a soul, hangs by the neck until dead. Chapter 57, Friday, April 21st, 1865, Washington, D.C., 7 a.m. 1 week after the assassination, even as John Wilkes Booth is still alive and hiding in a Maryland swamp, the body of Abraham Lincoln is loaded aboard a special train for the return home to Illinois. General Ulysses S. Grant supervises the occasion. The body of Lincoln's late son, Willie, rides along in a nearby casket. Abraham Lincoln once confided to Mary that he longed to be buried someplace quiet, and so it is that the president and his dear son are destined for Springfield's Oak Ridge Cemetery. But even after the burial, Lincoln's body will never quite be at rest. In the next 150 years, Lincoln's casket will be opened 6 times and moved from one crypt to another 17 times. His body was so thoroughly embalmed that he was effectively mummified. The funeral, which is quite different from the actual burial, was held on Wednesday, April 19th. 600 mourners were ushered into the East Room of the White House, its walls decorated in black, the mirrors all covered, and the room lit by candles. General Grant sat alone, nearest his dear departed friend. Next to a cross of lilies, he wept. Mary Lincoln is still so distraught that she will spend the next 5 weeks sobbing alone in her bedroom. She was notably absent from the list of recorded attendees at the funeral. The sound of hammers pounding nails all night long on Tuesday, creating the seating risers for the funeral guests, sounded like the horrible ring of gunfire to Mary. Out of respect for her mourning and instability, President Andrew Johnson will not have the platforms torn down until after she moves out on May 22nd. Immediately after the funeral, Lincoln's body was escorted by a military guard through the streets of Washington. 100,000 mourners lined the route to the Capitol, where the body was once again put on view for the public to pay their last respects. And now, 2 days later, there is the matter of the train. In a trip that will recreate his journey to the White House 5 years earlier, though in the opposite direction, Lincoln's special train will stop along the way in 12 cities and pass through 444 communities, In what will be called the greatest funeral in the history of the United States, 30 million people will take time from their busy lives to see this very special train before its great steel wheels finally slow to a halt in Lincoln's beloved Springfield. The unfortunate mementos of his assassination remain behind in Washington. The Derringer bullet and the probe that pinpointed its location in his brain will soon be on display in a museum, as will a red horsehair rocker in which he was shot. He also leaves behind the messy, unfinished business of healing the nation. And while Abraham Lincoln has gone home to finally get the rest he has so long deserved, that unfinished business will have to wait until his killer is found. Chapter 58, Friday, April 21st, 1865, Maryland Countryside, noon. Samuel Mudd is not home when Lieutenant Lovett and the cavalry unit return. Lovett sends farmhand Thomas Davis to find Mudd, but the doctor is having lunch nearby and quickly returns to his farm to face Lovett. The terror of their previous encounter returns. He knows that Lovett has spent the previous 3 days searching the area around his property for evidence. Mudd's face once again turns a ghostly white. His nervousness is compounded as Lovett questions him again, probing Mudd's story for discrepancies, half-truths, and outright lies. This time Lovett does not ride away, nor is he content to search the pastures and outer edges of the farm. No, this time, Lovett goes inside Mudd's home and sees precisely where the stranger slept. Lovett gives the order to search the house. Mudd frantically gestures to his wife Sarah, who walks quickly to him. He whispers in her ear, and she races into the house. The soldiers can hear her footsteps as she climbs the stairs to the second floor, then returns within just a moment. In her hands are two items, a razor and a boot. "I found these while dusting up 3 days ago," she says, and hands them to Lovett. Mudd explains that one of the strangers used a razor to shave off his mustache. The boot had come from the stranger with the broken leg. Lovett presses Mudd on this point, asking him if he knew the man's identity. Mudd insists that he did not. Lovett cradles a long riding boot in his hands. It has been slit down one side by Mudd in order that it might pull from Booth's swollen leg to examine the wound. Lovett asks if this indeed is the boot the stranger wore. Mudd agrees. Lovett presses Mudd again, verifying that the doctor had no knowledge of the stranger's identity. Mudd swears this to be the truth. And then Lovett shows Mudd the inside of the riding boot, which would have been clearly visible when Mudd was removing it from the stranger's leg. Mudd's world collapses. His story is shattered in an instant. For marked inside the boot, plain for all to see, is the name J. Wilkes. Dr. Samuel Mudd is under arrest. And while Lieutenant Lovett has just made a key breakthrough in the race to find John Wilkes Booth and David Harold, the truth is that nobody in authority knows where they are. Lafayette Baker, however, has a pretty good idea. Baker keeps a host of coastal survey maps in his office at the War Department. With that quick detective intuition amounting to almost inspiration, in his own words, he knows that Booth's escape options are limited. When news of the discovery of the abandoned riding boot makes its way back to Washington, Baker concludes that Booth cannot be traveling on horseback. And though traveling by water is more preferable, once Booth is flushed from the swamps, for that is surely where he's hiding, he won't follow the Maryland coastline. There are too many deep rivers to cross, and he would be easily spotted. Lafayette Baker also deduces that Booth won't head toward Richmond if he gets across the Potomac, because that would lead him straight into Union lines. Baker is already convinced that John Wilkes Booth must aim for the mountains of Kentucky. Being aware that nearly every rod of ground in lower Maryland must have been repeatedly passed over by the great number of persons engaged in the search, he will later write, "I finally decided in my own mind that Booth and Harold had crossed the river into Virginia. The only possible way left open to escape was to take a southwestern course in order to reach the mountains of Tennessee or Kentucky, where such aid could be secured as would ensure their ultimate escape from the country." It's as if Baker already knows Booth's plan. To get to Kentucky, Booth must cross the great breadth of Virginia, following almost the exact same path General Lee took in his escape from Petersburg. But he has no horse, which means traveling by water or on the main roads in a buggy, and he must cross treacherous territory to get south of Richmond. Baker studies his maps, searching for the precise spot where Booth might cross the Potomac. His eyes zoom in on Port Tobacco. If any place in the world is utterly given over to depravity, it is port tobacco, he will quote a journalist as saying in his memoirs. 500 people exist in port tobacco. Life there reminds me, in connection with the slimy river and the adjacent swamps, of the great reptile period of the world, when dinosaurs ate each other. Lafayette Baker is wrong, but not by much. Chapter 59, Friday, April 21st, 1865, Maryland Swamps, Nighttime. 6 days. Six long, cold, miserable days. That's how long Booth and Harold have now been in the swamp, scratching at wood ticks, shivering under thin, damp wool blankets, and eating just one meal a day provided by Thomas Jones. The silence has almost been complete, save for the times when Union warships on the Potomac fire their big guns to salute the fallen president. The newspapers delivered daily by Jones continue to be a source of information and misery, as it becomes more and more clear to Booth that his actions have condemned him. Booth would rant about the injustice if he had the energy. The fact is, he and Harold long ago tired of speaking in a whisper. And even if they hadn't, they have nothing to talk about. The sizzle of happiness that accompanied killing Lincoln is long gone. Booth is a man accustomed to the finest things in life, and his miserable existence in the swamp has him longing for the tender flesh of Lucy Hale, a bottle of whiskey, a plate of oysters, and a warm bed. Booth is just settling in for another night in the swamp when he hears the first whistle. Harold hears it too, and is on his feet in an instant. Grabbing his rifle, Harold warily approaches the sound and returns with Jones. "The coast seems to be clear," Jones tells them, his voice betraying the sense of urgency. "Let us make the attempt." Their camp is 3 miles from the river. Getting to the Potomac undetected means traveling down well-used public roads. Despite the darkness, they might run into a cavalry detail at any moment, but it's a chance they have to take. Booth cannot walk, so Jones loans him his horse. Harold and Jones help Booth into the saddle. The actor clings precariously to the horse's mane, desperate not to fall off. Jones tells them to wait, then walks ahead to make sure the coast is clear. Only when he whistles that all is well do they follow. This is how they travel to the river, the ever-vigilant Jones utilizing the smuggling skills he honed so well during the war to lead them to safety. Their pace is frustratingly slow to Booth, who wants to canter the horse as quickly as he can manage to the river. But Jones is taking no chances. When they approach Jones's house, Booth begs to be allowed inside for a moment of warmth. He badly wants to get to the river, but he's also addicted to creature comforts. After 6 days out in the cold, something as simple as standing before a roaring fireplace feels like a version of heaven. Jones will not hear of it, reminding them that his servants are home and could possibly give them away. Instead, Jones walks inside and returns with hot food, reminding the two fugitives that this might be the last meal they eat for a while. They press on to the river. Jones is hidden a 12-foot-long boat at the water's edge, tied to a large oak tree. The bank is steep, and Booth must be carried down the slope. But soon he sits in the stern, grasping an oar. Harold perches in a bow. The night is still dark, for the moon has not risen. A cold mist hovers on the surface of the wide and treacherous Potomac. Safety is just across the river in Virginia, where the citizens are solidly pro-Confederacy. It's so close they can see it, but getting there means navigating unseen currents and tides that can force them far downriver or even backward. The river is 2 miles wide at this point and constantly patrolled by Union warships. Some are merely heading into Washington's Navy Yard after time at sea, while others are specifically hunting for two men in a small boat. It is common naval practice for ships to douse their running lights at night, all the better to thwart smugglers. Booth and Harold might actually run headlong into a ship without even seeing it in the total darkness. "Keep to that," Jones instructs Booth, lighting a small candle to illuminate Booth's compass and pointing to the southwesterly heading. The actor has carried the compass since the assassination, just for a moment like this. "It will take you into Mackinac Creek. Mrs. Quisenberry lives near the mouth of this creek. If you tell her you come from me, I think she will take care of you." "God bless you, my dear friend," says Booth. "Goodbye." They shove off. Jones turns his back and returns home, his work complete. No other man has risked as much nor shown as much compassion for Booth and Harold as Jones. He did not do it because he applauded the assassination. In fact, Jones is disgusted by Booth's action. Rather, he helped the two men out of compassion for men in trouble and a last-ditch bout of loyalty to the Confederacy. His deeds will go unpunished. When his part in the conspiracy will be revealed later on, the testimony will come from a non-white resident of Southern Maryland and thus will be ignored. Booth and Harold, meantime, paddle hard for the opposite shore. That is, Harold paddles hard. Booth sits in the back and dangles his oar in the water under the pretense of steering. Harold paddles for several hours against a daunting current, but they're going the wrong way. Booth's compass may be a prized possession, but it's useless if not utilized properly. Things go from bad to worse. The fugitives almost paddle headlong into the Juniper, a federal gunboat. And yet if anyone on deck of the 80-footer sees them, they do not cry out. Finally, they land 4 miles upriver from where they departed, still in Maryland. Their escape is not going well. They are forced to hide themselves and their boat in the brush for yet another day. And so, after one long last 24 hours of hiding from the thousands of soldiers now combing the countryside looking for them, John Wilkes Booth and David Harrell once again set out under the cover of darkness, rowing hard for Virginia. This time, they make it. Next stop, Kentucky. Chapter 60, Monday, Tuesday, April 24th, 25th, 1865, Virginia-Maryland border, daytime. Samuel Beckwith is in Port Tobacco, the Gomorrah, in Lafayette Baker's words, of Maryland. He is the telegraph operator specifically detailed by Baker to keep the detective apprised of all actions in the Booth dragnet. Now he telegraphs a coded message back to Washington stating that investigators have questioned local smugglers and learned that Booth and Harold have gone across the Potomac River. The evidence is, in fact, erroneous. It refers to a group of men smuggled into Virginia on Easter Sunday, not Booth and Harold. Lafayette Baker immediately reacts, however, sending 25 members of the 16th New York Cavalry by steamship John S. Ide from Washington downriver to Belle Plaine, Virginia. All of the men have volunteered for the mission. The senior officers are Baker's cousin, Lieutenant Luther Baker, and Colonel Everton Conger, a 29-year-old, highly regarded veteran of the Civil War. Lafayette Baker sees them off. "I want you to go to Virginia and get Booth," he says, and then puts his cousin in charge, despite the lower rank. The Ide pushes back at 2 p.m. for the four-hour-long voyage. It arrives at the simple wharf and warehouse along the shore just after dark. The men immediately spur their horses down the main road of Belle Plaine, Virginia, and then into the countryside, knocking on farmhouse doors and questioning the occupants. They stop any and all riders and carriages they encounter, pressing hard for clues as to Booth's whereabouts. But nobody has seen Booth or Harold, or if they have, they're not talking. By morning, the cavalry squad is in Port Conway, more than 10 miles inland from the Potomac. Exhausted, their horses wrung out from the long night, the soldiers are starting to feel as if this is just another futile lead. Conger has promised them all an equal share of the more than $200,000 in reward money awaiting those who capture Booth. This spurred them to ride all night, but now the prize seems unattainable. They are growing fearful that the Ide will return to Washington without them, leaving them to wait days for another ship. During their trip south, Lieutenant Luther Baker made the rather wise decision to give the command back to Conger. "You have been over the ground," he told the veteran. Then, just as they are about to give up and go home, on the shores of the Rappahannock River, at a ferry crossing known as Port Royal, two men positively identify photographs of Booth and Harold. They passed through the previous day and were traveling with a small group of Confederate veterans. By this time, the 25 cavalry soldiers are exhausted, so haggard and wasted with travel that they had to be kicked into intelligence before they could climb into their saddles, Lieutenant Baker will later recall. But climb into the saddles they do, for hours and hours of more searching. At 2 o'clock in the morning, at a handsome whitewashed farm 300 yards off the main road, the soldiers finally come to a halt. The ground is soft clay, so their horses' hooves make no sound. The soldiers draw their carbines from their scabbards as Lieutenant Baker dismounts and opens the property's main gate. He has no certain knowledge of anything nefarious. It is just a hunch. Fanning out, the riders make a circle around the house and the barn. In a very few minutes, Lieutenant Baker's hunch will make history. Chapter 61, Wednesday, April 26, 1865, Garrett Farm, Virginia, dusk to dawn. Until just a few hours ago, John Wilkes Booth was happier and more content than at any time since killing Lincoln. His broken leg notwithstanding, his 3 days in Virginia with his pro-Confederate citizens and custom of hospitality have made him think that escape is a likely possibility. He even disclosed his identity to a group of former Southern soldiers he met along the road. To everyone else who asked, he's a former soldier who was injured at Petersburg and is on his way home. He spent the last day at the farmhouse of Richard Garrett, whose son John just returned home from the war. The Garretts do not know Booth's true identity and believe his story about being a former soldier. He's enjoyed hot meals and the chance to wash and sleep. But an hour before sunset came word that the Federal cavalry were crossing the ferry over the Rappahannock River. Booth reacted to the news with visible fear. The Garretts, seeing this, grow suspicious and insist that both men leave. Booth and Harold refuse, though not in a belligerent manner. Not knowing what to do and not wanting to create a problem with the two armed strangers, John Garrett sends them to sleep in the barn. Now Booth and Harold hide in a 48-by-54 wooden structure filled with hay and corn. Tobacco curing equipment is stored inside, and thick cedar beams provide sturdy structural support. Worried that Booth and Harold plan to steal their horses and escape in the night, John and his brother William sleep outside the barn, armed with a pistol. Booth doesn't realize that Garrett brothers are outside guarding the barn, nor does he know that the cavalry is surrounding the house. All he is sure of is that it is 2 a.m. and dogs begin barking. Then a terrified John Garrett steps into the barn and orders the men to give up their weapons. The building is surrounded, he tells them. Get out of here, Booth cries, or I will shoot you. You have betrayed me. Garrett flees, locking the barn door behind him. Booth and Harold are now trapped inside, with no idea how many men are out there. Then Harold says he wants out. He's sick of this life and wants to go home. He's done nothing wrong and wishes to proclaim his innocence. Captain Booth calls out, not knowing the proper rank to use. There is a man here who very much wants to surrender. Then he turns to Harold in disgust. Go away from me, damned coward. Harold exits through the main door, wrist first. He is immediately taken away and arrested by the soldiers. Lieutenant Baker calls to Booth, telling him that the barn will be set on fire within moments unless Booth surrenders. Well, Captain, Booth cries out, his old sense of the dramatic now fully returned. You may prepare a stretcher for me. Draw up your men. Throw open the door. Let's have a fair fight. Then Booth hears the crackle of burning straw and smells the sickly sweet wood smoke of burning cedar. One more stain on the old banner, he yells, doing his best to sound fearless. No one quite knows what the statement means. He looks across the barn and sees Lieutenant Baker opening the door. The actor hefts his loaded carbine, preparing to take aim. Just as Abraham Lincoln felt a slight instant of pain, and then nothing at all when Booth shot him, now Booth hears the crack of a rifle and feels a jolt in his neck, and then nothing. Sergeant Boston Corbett has fired a bullet and it slices through Booth's spinal cord and paralyzes him from the neck down. John Wilkes Booth collapses to the floor of the barn, the flames now climbing higher and higher all around him. Boston Corbett, in his own way, is as much a zealot as Booth, only his passion is religion. Incredibly, years before, Corbett cut off his own testicles with a pair of scissors after experiencing a moment of lust. Booth has now been shot by a man very much like himself, a rebellious fanatic. Corbett actually disobeyed orders when taking aim at the actor. Baker and Conger pull John Wilkes Booth from the barn moments before it is completely engulfed in flames. The actor is still alive. As with Lincoln, the decision is made not to transport him, for any movement will surely kill Booth. But he is dead by morning anyway. His limp body is hurled into the back of a garbage wagon. The flight and life of John Wilkes Booth has come to an end. He is just 26 years old. Chapter 62, Friday, July 7th, 1865, Washington, Dawn. 2.5 months later, the rounding up of Lincoln's killers has become a national pastime. Secretary of War Stanton has personally taken charge of identifying the larger conspiracy that has grown out of Booth's single gunshot, pushing Lafayette Baker from the limelight. While some in the Confederate South now call Booth a martyr and hang pictures of him in their homes as they would for a family member, Northerners are even more determined to see every last one of his co-conspirators found and killed. The jails are full of men and women who have been trapped in the spider's web of the Stanton investigation. Some have absolutely nothing to do with Lincoln's death, like James Pumphrey, the Confederate sympathizing owner of a stable who spent a month behind bars. No one is immune from suspicion. Federal agents scour their list of suspects, making sure no one is overlooked. One missing suspect is 21-year-old John Surratt, whose mother Mary provided Booth and his conspirators with weapons and lodging. Mary herself sits inside the old Arsenal Penitentiary, awaiting her fate. She's been locked up since her arrest on April 17th. The trial of all her co-conspirators, including Mary, began on May 10th, and some 366 witnesses were called before it was over 7 weeks later. From the beginning, the public viewed all the conspirators as clearly criminals. Certainly the drunken George Azarode and the brutish thug who attacked the sewers, Lewis Powell, looked the part. But Mary Surratt is different. Standing 5'6", with a buxom figure and a pretty smile that captivates some of the journalists in attendance, Mary has initially engendered some sympathy, and many Americans wonder if her life should be spared. But Mary's physical appearance, like that of her co-conspirators, began to change as the trial stretched into its 6th and 7th weeks. Stanton was responsible for this disfiguring transformation. When not on trial, Stanton insisted that all the conspirators had to wear a thick padded hood over their heads. Extra cotton padding was placed over the eyelids, pressing hard against the eyeballs. There was just one slit at the mouth for eating. The purpose was to prevent them from seeing or hearing one another as they remained chained in the bowels of the Montauk, the warship President Lincoln visited on the last day of his life. Underneath the hoods, the heat was intense and the air stifling. The sweating and the bloating of the skin from the heavy hoods made each conspirator appear more and more swollen and rabid with each passing day. Mary Surratt endured an even greater private hell. In addition to the claustrophobia and disfigurement caused by the hood, she suffered from severe cramping, excessive menstruating, and constant urinating from a disease known as endometriosis. She was barely tended to by her captors or given the freedom to properly care for herself. One eyewitness called her cell aboard the Montauk barely habitable. Sick and trapped in this filthy cell, Mary Surratt took on a haunted, bloated appearance. After deliberating for 3 days, the 9-member jury finds Mary Surratt, Lewis Powell, George Azarode, and David Harold guilty. They will be hanged. As for Dr. Samuel Mudd, Michael O'Loughlin, Ned Spangler, and Samuel Arnold, their punishment will be the remote penitentiary of Fort Jefferson in the Gulf of Mexico. There is no one willing to speak up for the men who will hang, but Mary Surratt's priest comes to her defense. So does her daughter Anna, though not her missing son John. Mary Surratt's attorney frantically works to get an audience with President Andrew Johnson so that he might personally intervene on her behalf. Her supporters say she was just a lone woman trying to make ends meet by providing weapons for Booth and his conspiracy and point out that she didn't pull the trigger and was nowhere near Ford's theater. There is hope, but not much. The other three sentenced to hang are all part of Booth's inner circle. Not so with Mary Surratt. Although Johnson will not speak to him, her attorney continues to argue to the fringe of President Johnson's outer circle, those who actively prevent him from speaking with the president himself. The attorney says Mary's life should be spared. Mary Surratt spends the night of July 6th in prayer, asking God to spare her life. In the morning, she refuses breakfast, and even at 10 a.m., when her visitors are told to leave so that her body can be prepared, Mary is still hoping. She wears a black dress and veil. Her ankles and wrists are manacled, and then she is marched out into a blazing summer sun. She looks up at the 10-foot-high gallows, newly built for the execution of her and the other conspirators. She sees the freshly dug graves beneath the gallows, the spot where her body will rest for all eternity. Mary Surratt, Lewis Powell, George Azarode, and David Harold climb the gallows staircase. They are seated in chairs on the platform at the top. Their hands and arms are tied to their bodies, the men's with ropes, Mary's with white cloth. Their legs are tied together at the ankles and knees so they will not kick wildly after the hangman springs the door. Mary Surratt is innocent, Powell cries out just before a white cotton hood is placed over his head. Outside the prison, Mary's supporters gather. Time is short, but there is still hope. Soldiers stand atop the penitentiary walls just in case a last-minute rider approaches with a pardon. Inside the penitentiary, 100 civilians have won the right to watch Lincoln's killers die. The muggy air is thick with anticipation. All it takes is one word from President Johnson. Mary Surratt continues to pray. "Please don't let me fall," she says to an executioner, getting vertigo as she looks down on the crowd from atop the tall, unstable gallows. He puts the white hood over her head, and then she stands alone, terrified that she might topple forward over the edge of the gallows before the pardon can arrive. The death sentences are read in alphabetical order by General Winfield Scott Hancock, another old friend of Generals Grant and Lee from their days in Mexico. Each trapdoor is held in place by a single post. At the bottom of the scaffold stand four hand-selected members of the armed forces. It is their job to kick away the posts on the signal from the hangman. Suddenly, that signal is given. The trapdoors swing open. Mary Surratt, like the others, drops 6 feet in an instant. But unlike the others, her neck does not break, and she does not die right away. The 42-year-old mother and widow, whose son would not come to her rescue out of fear for his own life, swings for 5 long minutes before her larynx is crushed and her body stops fighting for air. Stanton lets the bodies dangle in the wind for 20 more minutes before pronouncing that he is satisfied. The corpses are then buried in the hard prison yard. Mary Surratt becomes the first and the only woman ever hanged by the U.S. government. Afterward. The saga of Lincoln's assassination went on long after he died. Indeed, it continues to this day, as historians and amateur sleuths alike debate the never-ending list of conspiracy theories. The full truth may never be known. As for the other key figures in the dramatic events of April 1865, their fates are now part of the historical record. The body of John Wilkes Booth was returned to Washington on the John S. Ide. Booth's dentist and his personal physician were both brought on board and testified that the body was that of Booth. It was photographed, and then the Surgeon General, Joseph Barnes, who attended to Lincoln in the president's final hours, performed an autopsy while the ship was sailing. The cause of death was determined to be a gunshot wound in the neck, with the added notation that paralysis was immediate after Booth was shot, and all the horrors and consciousness of suffering and death must have been present to the assassin during the 2 hours he lingered. Dr. Barnes removed the 3rd, 4th, and 5th cervical vertebrae from Booth's neck. These clearly showed the path of the bullet as it entered then exited the body. The vertebrae are now housed at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in the National Museum of Health and Medicine, although they are not on public display. Dr. Barnes then returned his completed autopsy over to Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, who also took control of the photographs made of the corpse and of Booth's diary, which was handed to him by Lafayette Baker. Curiously, the photographs soon disappeared, and when Baker was later called upon to verify that Booth's diary actually belonged to the killer, he was astonished to see that 18 leaves or pages had been cut from the journal, allegedly by Secretary Stanton. Neither the photographs nor the missing pages have ever been found, casting more suspicion on Stanton's possible role in a conspiracy. The Secretary of War wished the Booth situation to be handled with as little public outcry as possible, and this meant forbidding a public funeral. On Stanton's orders, Lafayette Baker staged a mock burial, wrapping the body in a horse blanket and publicly hurling it into the Potomac. However, this was just a ruse to conceal the body's actual location. After the crowd on the shore watched Baker dump the weighted object into the river, the ship traveled around a bend to the site of the old penitentiary on the grounds of the Washington Arsenal. The assassin was buried in an anonymous grave beneath the prison's dirt floor, his body concealed inside the gun box that served as his casket. When 2 years later the penitentiary was shuttered and leveled, Booth's remains were moved to the family plot at Green Mount Cemetery in Baltimore, where they remain to this day. Despite all the evidence that Booth is actually dead and buried in the grave bearing his name, various legends have maintained that he escaped into the South and lived a long life. In December 2010, Booth's descendants agreed to exhume the remains of Edwin Booth to see if DNA from his body is a match for the DNA in the vertebrae housed at Walter Reed. As the chief historian for the Naval Medical Department noted, if it compares favorably, then that's the end of the controversy. If it doesn't match, you change American history. As of this writing, the outcome of that investigation is still pending. Mary Lincoln never recovered from Abraham Lincoln's assassination. She insisted on wearing only the color black for the rest of her life. Mary lingered in the White House for several weeks after the shooting, then returned home to Illinois, where she spent her time answering the many letters of condolence she received from around the world, and also lobbying Congress for a pension. This was granted in 1870 for the sum of $3,000 per year. However, just when it appeared that Mary was recovering from her considerable grief, in 1871, her 18-year-old son Tad died of a mysterious heart condition. This brought upon a downward spiral of mental instability, dramatized in spending sprees, paranoia, and delusions, and once she almost jumped out of a building after wrongly believing she saw flames consuming the structure. Mary's only remaining son, Robert, had her committed to a mental institution in 1875. She spent a year there, during which she engaged in a letter-writing campaign to the Chicago Tribune that so embarrassed Robert, he had her released. Mary moved to the south of France for 4 years, living in exile in the town of Pau, before returning to Springfield. Mary Lincoln died in 1882 at the age of 63. She is buried alongside her husband. Robert Todd Lincoln went on to a stellar career as an attorney and then public official. He served as Secretary of War from 1881 to 85 during the James Garfield and Chester Arthur administrations, and served as U.S. Minister to Great Britain from 1889 to 1893 under Benjamin Harrison. Although he was not present at Ford's Theater when his father was assassinated, he was an eyewitness to Garfield's assassination in 1881 and nearby when President William McKinley was assassinated in 1901. John Wilkes Booth would have been enraged to know that Robert Lincoln and Lucy Lambert Hale spent the afternoon of Lincoln's assassination together studying Spanish. It's possible that Lucy could have mentioned this upcoming appointment to the assassin during their final moments together that morning, fueling his jealousy. In the end, it doesn't really matter, because Lucy Lambert Hale will forever be linked with John Wilkes Booth. Secretary Stanton, out of respect for her father's position, refused to let Lucy be called upon to testify at the trial. However, there were rumors that she was smuggled aboard the Ides to view Booth's body and wept openly at the sight. This has never been confirmed. Regardless, the intimacy of their relationship soon became widespread knowledge in Washington, and she was only too happy to escape to Spain for the next 5 years, while her father served as ambassador. Lucy and Robert Todd Lincoln continued to maintain a friendly relationship, but she chose to marry William Chandler in 1874. She bore one child, a son, at the age of 44. William Chandler went on to serve as Secretary of the Navy. Then grandson, Theodore Chandler, would become a highly decorated World War II Navy admiral who was killed when kamikazes attacked his ship in the Pacific. Lucy Lambert Hale died of natural causes in 1915 at the age of 74. Robert Todd Lincoln died at his home in Vermont at the age of 82, though not before being present for the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington in 1922. He is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Laura Keene would regret cradling Lincoln's head in her lap that night in Ford's Theater. The assassination linked her troop with the killing, and the attendant notoriety was hard on her already floundering career. The actress was eminently resourceful, however, and left America to barnstorm through England before returning in 1869 to manage the Chestnut Street Theater in Philadelphia. She later took to lecturing on the fine arts and publishing a weekly art journal. Laura King died of tuberculosis on November 4, 1873 in Montclair, New Jersey. She was believed to be 47, although she was often vague about her actual birth date and may have been 3 years older. Edwin Stanton did not live long after the death of Abraham Lincoln, and those years he did live were fraught with controversy. Stanton clashed repeatedly with President Andrew Johnson over the process of Reconstruction. Johnson's vengeful policies toward the South were in direct contrast with what Lincoln had hoped for, and despite their earlier animosity toward each other, Stanton was keen to see Lincoln's wishes put into place. Tensions between Stanton and Johnson got so bad that in 1868 the president fired Stanton as Secretary of War and replaced him with Ulysses S. Grant. Stanton refused to leave the office and was vindicated when the Senate voted that Johnson's actions were illegal. Johnson tried once again to replace Stanton, this time with General Lorenzo Thomas. Stanton barricaded himself in his office to avoid being removed. The Senate, which had openly clashed with Johnson over other key issues, now began impeachment hearings, stating that Johnson did not have the authority to remove the Secretary of War. Though Johnson escaped removal from office by one vote in the Senate, Stanton was the clear winner in the case. He retired soon after the vote, only to be nominated as a justice to the Supreme Court by the newly elected president, Ulysses S. Grant. Edwin Stanton died before he could take the oath. The end came on Christmas Eve, 1869, at the age of 55. Stanton died from a sudden and very severe asthma attack. Did he have any part in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln? To this day, there are those who believe he did, but nothing has ever been proved. Few men could have successfully followed Abraham Lincoln as president, but Andrew Johnson proved particularly inept. His Reconstruction policies were bitterly divisive, to the point that he openly warred with members of his own party. He dodged impeachment, but was not reelected to office in 1868. Later in life, Johnson was reelected to the Senate, but soon afterward he died from a stroke on July 31, 1875. Lafayette Baker became an instant celebrity for finding Lincoln's killer. The red-bearded detective wrote a best-selling memoir in 1867 entitled The History of the United States Secret Service. In the book, he detailed his role in finding John Wilkes Booth. Several of his claims, including that he'd handed Booth's diary to Edwin Stanton, led to a congressional investigation into his role in the disappearance of that diary. Soldiers had given Baker the diary upon returning to Washington with Booth's body. Baker then gave it to Stanton, who locked it in a safe for almost 2 years, never telling investigators that he had the crucial piece of evidence in his possession. The publication of Baker's memoir provoked a great public demand for Stanton to produce the diary. He did so reluctantly, but as we stated, 18 pages were missing. The Secretary of War denied being responsible for excising the pages. The investigation ended without a formal placement of blame. In 1960, a controversial amateur historian named Ray Neff came upon a description of the Lincoln assassination in a copy of Colburn's United Service magazine, a British military journal. The article was dated February 5, 1868. Lafayette Baker was the author. Neff claims to have deciphered a coded message from Baker within the story. The substitution code revealed a message that reads thus: "It was on the 10th of April, 1865, when I first knew that the plan was in action. I did not know the identity of the assassin, but I knew most all else when I approached Edward Stanton about it. He at once acted surprised and disbelieving. Later he said, 'You are a party to it, too.'" Baker, decoded by Neff, goes on to add, "There were at least 11 members of Congress involved in the plot, no less than 20 Army officers, 3 naval officers, and at least 24 civilians, of which one was a governor of a loyal state. 5 were bankers of great repute, 3 were nationally known newspaper men, and 11 were industrialists of great repute and wealth. $85,000 was contributed by the named persons to pay for the deed. Only 8 persons knew the details of the plot and the identity of the others. I fear for my life." There is no consensus about whether Neff's hidden message is authentic. It could be made up. What we do know is that Stanton did not hesitate to ask the previously disgraced Baker to lead the Booth investigation. This at a time when the Secretary of War had every single detective in the nation at his disposal, and that Baker magically pinpointed Booth's actual location when thousands of soldiers and detectives combing the woods and swamps could not. It should be noted that Neff's hypothesis and his entire body of work had been repudiated and dismissed by the vast majority of trained historians and assassination scholars. Civil War Times, which originally published his findings about the cipher messages, later denounced him. Once Neff became involved with the movie The Lincoln Conspiracy and began promoting bizarre theories about Booth's escape and a later second life in India, he became even more ostracized from mainstream scholars. The fact remains, however, that Stanton's withholding of Booth's diary was suspicious, as is the subject of the 18 missing pages. No one has adequately explained this behavior, thus allowing some conspiracy buffs to continue to wonder if he had a larger role in Lincoln's assassination. Baker became increasingly paranoid after the congressional investigation, certain that he would be murdered, and he was right. Just 18 months after the investigation, He was found dead in his home in Philadelphia. While Baker was at first believed to have died from meningitis, evidence now points to a slow and systematic death by poisoning. Again, this evidence comes from Ray Neff, the Indiana State University professor, used an atomic absorption system to analyze strands of Baker's hair. The results showed that arsenic had been slowly introduced into his system during the last months of his life. Comparing the rising levels of arsenic with diary entries made by Baker's wife, Neff noted a correlation with visits from Wally Pollock, Baker's brother-in-law, who was in the habit of bringing imported German beer to Baker's house whenever he came calling. Pollock, not incidentally, also worked under Secretary Stanton as a War Department employee. The suspicion is that Pollock poisoned Baker by mixing small amounts of arsenic into the beer. Whether or not he acted alone is a matter of conjecture. Abraham Lincoln's irresponsible bodyguard, John Parker, never presented himself for duty or tried to help in any way on the night of the assassination. Incredibly, Parker was not held accountable for shirking his duties. In fact, the first time he was seen after the assassination was when he showed up at a Washington police station the next morning in the company of a known prostitute. Formal police charges of dereliction of duty were pressed against Parker, but once again he was acquitted. 3 years later, after many attempts to remove him from the police department, Parker was finally booted for gross neglect of duty. He went on to work as a carpenter and machinist. He died of pneumonia on June 28, 1890, at the age of 60. Lincoln's responsible bodyguard, William Crook, had a more esteemed career, working in the White House for more than 50 years, a time that spanned administrations from Abraham Lincoln's to Woodrow Wilson's. However, it was his relationship with Lincoln that he treasured most, and his 1910 memoirs provide a vivid insight into the journey to Richmond and the events of April 14th. Critics have accused Crook of padding his own part, but the book makes for compelling reading. William Crook died in 1915 from pneumonia at the age of 77. He was buried in Arlington National Cemetery in a service attended by President Wilson. After the war, Robert E. Lee applied for a pardon for his acts against the United States. Secretary of State William H. Seward did not file a pardon, but instead gave it to a friend as a souvenir. The document wasn't discovered for more than 100 years. President Gerald Ford officially reinstated Lee as a U.S. citizen in 1975. Marsh Robert was buried not at his beloved Virginia home, Arlington, which was confiscated during the war and redesigned as a U.S. military cemetery, but at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. He died on Columbus Day, 1870, at the age of 63. Lee's counterpart on the Union side, General Grant, had an admirable career after the war ended. He remained in the Army, helping to implement Reconstruction policies that guaranteed the black vote. He saw his popularity soar in the North. Elected president in 1868, he served two terms in office. Grant's later years were filled with travel and later financial upheaval. After losing his entire fortune to bad investments in the early 1880s, he sat down to, with the help of his editor Mark Twain, write his memoirs. Considered by many to be one of the best military autobiographies in history, Grant's life story was a bestseller. Royalties from the book guaranteed his family a comfortable life long after he died of throat cancer on July 23, 1885. The question, who is buried in Grant's tomb, seems an obvious one, for Ulysses S. Grant is buried in this enormous mausoleum in New York's Riverside Park. However, so is Julia Grant. She died on December 14, 1902, at the age of 76, and now lies alongside her husband. After being discovered alive on the battlefield that day after the battle for Highbridge, Colonel Francis Washburn was immediately transported to a field hospital, then home to Massachusetts, where he died 1 week after Lincoln did. Coincidentally, he passed away on the exact same day as the Confederacy's general, James Deering, his opposite, on the field of battle. They were the last two casualties of Highbridge. Two officers present at Sailor's Creek, General James Pete Longstreet and General George Armstrong Custer, followed remarkably different paths after the Civil War. Longstreet's longtime friendship with General Grant figured prominently in his embrace of pro-Union Reconstruction efforts, much to the chagrin of die-hard rebels who soon began an active series of revisionist attacks on the great Southern general, attempting somewhat successfully to impugn his reputation as a leader and paint him as a coward. By the time Longstreet died in 1904, at the age of 82, He has served as a diplomat, a civil servant, and a U.S. Marshal. A house fire consumed all of his Civil War memorabilia, leaving almost no legacy other than his autobiography to set his wartime record straight. General Custer continued to fight, using the same aggressive, impulsive tactics that served him so successfully at Sailor's Creek. In his time, he would become far better known for his battles on America's western frontier and for his friendships with other larger-than-life figures, such as Buffalo Bill Cody. In June 1876, Custer and his 7th Cavalry were sent to Montana to force Sioux and Cheyenne Indians back to their reservations. On the morning of June 25th, his scouts reported that a small band of warriors were camped along the Little Bighorn River. Behaving in much the same fashion as he did at Sailor's Creek, Custer split his cavalry into three columns and attacked without making a preliminary study of the terrain. The results were disastrous. Custer and his men were soon cut off, surrounded by a vastly superior force of Sioux under the legendary warrior Crazy Horse. Custer ordered his men to shoot their horses and stack the bodies to shield them from the oncoming rifle fire. But within an hour, every last man was dead. When the Battle of the Little Bighorn was over, the bodies of the slain soldiers were stripped and mutilated, thanks to an Indian belief that the soul of a mutilated body would wander the earth without rest for eternity. Scalps were taken, stomachs slit open, eardrums pierced, and genitals dismembered. In the case of Custer's brother, Tom, who had won his second of two Congressional Medals of Honor at Sailor's Creek, his heart was cut out and eaten. Another brother, 27-year-old Boston, was also killed and scalped. Strangely, the only body left unmutilated was that of George Armstrong Custer. When U.S. soldiers later came upon the battlefield, they described Custer's face as being a mask of calm. A round 45 caliber bullet hole in his left temple and another just below his heart were the only signs of violence, and point to the likelihood that he was killed by a long-range rifle shot. Initially, Custer was buried in a shallow grave on the battlefield next to his brother Tom. News of the devastating defeat was quickly conveyed to Fort McPherson, Nebraska, then on to Washington by telegraph. Ironically, word of Custer's defeat arrived in the nation's capital on July 4, 1876, America's first centennial. In its own way, the death of Custer was as traumatizing as that of Lincoln, emboldening the United States Army to seek revenge against the Indians in the same way Lincoln's assassination had Northerners seeking revenge against the South. Custer was just 36 when he died. His body was later relocated from the Little Bighorn and buried at the United States Military Academy at West Point. William Seward would live just 7 more years after being attacked in his own bed on the night of Lincoln's assassination. But in that time, he would undertake an activity that would leave an even longer-lasting legacy than the heinous attack. In 1867, while still serving as Secretary of State and still bearing the disfiguring facial scars of the knife attack, he purchased Alaska for the United States. What soon became known as Seward's Folly would later be seen as a huge asset when silver and gold and oil were discovered in the new territory. Seward died on October 10, 1872. He was 71. Major Henry Reed Rathbone, present in the box on the night Lincoln was shot, later married his date from the evening, Clara Harris. Unfortunately for Harris, Rathbone later went insane and killed her with a knife. He was institutionalized for the remainder of his life. Boston Corbett, the man who shot John Wilkes Booth, received a handsome reward for the killing even though he disobeyed orders. He left the military soon afterward, first working as a hatter, then serving as an assistant doorman for the Kansas State Legislature. It appears that the mercury used in making hats, which was well known for causing insanity, giving rise to the term mad as a hatter, caused him to become mentally unstable. In 1887, he, too, was sent to an insane asylum after brandishing a revolver in the legislature. He escaped and moved north to Minnesota, where he died in the Great Hinckley Fire of 1894. He was 62. Dr. Samuel Mudd, Samuel Arnold, and Michael O'Loughlin were all given life sentences for their roles in the assassination conspiracy. Ned Spangler, the besotted scene shifter, received a 6-year sentence. All were sent to the Dry Tortugas, a baking-hot group of islands west of the Florida Keys. Their jailers, black Union soldiers, had complete power over the daily movements of these white supremacists. O'Loughlin died of fever while in prison at the age of 27. Spangler, Mudd, and Arnold were later pardoned in 1869 by Andrew Johnson and lived out their days as law-abiding citizens. The man who helped John Wilkes Booth and David Harold escape into Virginia, Thomas Jones, was circumspect about his role in the assassination for many years. He was taken into custody shortly after Booth was killed and spent 7 weeks in the old Capitol prison before being released. Even though he became a justice of the peace after the war, the tight-lipped former member of the Confederate Secret Service was ever wary of persecution after aiding John Wilkes Booth and David Harold. That changed in 1893 when he wrote a 126-page book telling his side of events. Jones died on March 5, 1895, at the age of 74. Perhaps the most shadowy figure in the Lincoln conspiracy, John Surratt, Mary Surratt's son, could have been instrumental in reducing his mother's sentence by showing that her part in the assassination was that of a passive support instead of active participation. But rather than give the testimony that might have spared her life, John Surratt fled to Montreal, Canada, immediately after the assassination, where he followed the news of his mother's trial and execution. Surratt then fled to England under an assumed name and later continued onto the Vatican. He was discovered there and arrested, but escaped. Another international search for Surratt soon found him in Alexandria, Egypt. Arrested again, he was brought back to the United States to appear before a judge. Amazingly, the jury deadlocked on his involvement. John Surratt was free to go. He died in 1916 at the age of 72. Mary Surratt's body was reburied in the Catholic cemetery at Mount Olivet in Washington, where it remains to this day. The petition to spare Mary's life never got to President Andrew Johnson. His assistant, Preston King, kept the information away from Johnson. But apparently that action preyed on King's conscience. A few months later, King tied a bag of bullets around his neck and leapt from a ferry boat into New York's harbor. He was never seen again. He was 59 years old. Epilogue. The last days of Abraham Lincoln's life included perhaps the most dramatic events in the nation's history. It is eerie that Abraham Lincoln found much solace in the play Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare, given that the two great men met their ends in the same way. Caesar was betrayed by his countrymen, as was Lincoln. Both men died within months of their 56th birthday, before they could complete their life's work. Just as the story of Julius Caesar has been told and retold for centuries, the tragedy that befell Lincoln should be known by every American. His life and death continue to shape us as a people even today. America is a great country, but like every other nation on earth, it is influenced by evil. John Wilkes Booth epitomizes the evil that can harm us, even as President Abraham Lincoln represents the good that can make us stronger. This is Bill O'Reilly. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Killing Lincoln. Killing Lincoln was directed by Scott Sherritt, recorded by Rick Buser. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2011 by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Production copyright 2011 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.